Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that has already posted its own lists of what the three of us think of as the best films of 2019. Still, since we live just a bit outside the movie mainstream, some of the most critically acclaimed films of last year are still opening. And in this week's show, we're going to discuss three of them. Sam Mendes' Study of War, 1917, which won big at the recent Golden Globe Awards, The Two Popes, which stars the Oscar-nominated actors Jonathan Pryce and Anthony Hopkins, and finally, A Hidden Life, the latest effort by master filmmaker Terrence Malick. And if we have time, we'll give a quick reaction to this week's Oscar nominations. Let's begin by immersing ourselves in the mud of 1917 France. Hollywood has always loved war films. From the Battle of Hastings to the Second Battle of Fallujah, some of the greatest cinema ever produced has come from the minds of our most talented filmmakers. Joining that group is Sam Mendes, whose previous notable films include 1999's American Beauty, for which he won a Best Director Oscar, and the 2012 James Bond film Skyfall. Mendes now has given us 1917, a film he both directed and co-wrote, retelling stories he recalls hearing from his World War I veteran grandfather. Told in more or less real time and shot in a manner by the great cinematographer Roger Deakins that gives the impression that it's all one single take, 1917 tells the story of two English soldiers who are sent on a desperate mission. They have to stop an attack that could result in the deaths of some 1,600 men, one of whom is the brother of one of our protagonists. So yes, war has been chronicled many times over the past century, but seldom has any film immersed the viewer this deeply and effectively into the stench of the mud, the blood, and the furor of war violence as 1917 does here.
Well, you know, there's that old story about Citizen Kane. Maybe you've heard of it, the movie, where Orson Welles actually shared he's the guy that directed Citizen Kane. He shared his directed by title card with his cinematographer, Greg Tolan, because he felt that Tolan's contributions to the look and feel
made
of Citizen Kane were as important as his as the director of the film. And I feel like you could say the same thing about Roger Deakins' contributions here.
Which Sam Mendes, to his credit, when he accepted his best director, he mentioned Roger Deakins.
Yeah, I mean, because I think that this movie is as much about the choreography of the camera crew and and all of the technicians as it is about the action happening on screen. And I do want to get into that because the conceit of this movie, I think, is the thing that makes it, for me at least, both really interesting and also kind of curious. But I want to talk about the way that Mendes portrays war here because I was reminded of two recent films. I mean, obviously these long kind of tracking shots through the trenches. You're thinking of Kubrick's Paths of Glory, where you're wondering how they were able to get a camera and all of these extras into this tiny, claustrophobic place. But I was thinking about Dunkirk, the Christopher Nolan movie, which of course is about a different war, but was also about young British soldiers, also had a ticking clock element. It's very set piece heavy. It's very stylish. And the Peter Jackson documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old, which was about World War I. And I thought that what this movie did well, at least in the way that it kind of thought about World War I, was how it portrayed the rot and the decay and the muck of the daily lives of these men. I mean, you just see these bloated corpses and these rats that are kind of infesting everything. And also just the pure chaos whenever combat breaks out, because as we learn from that documentary, and less so in 1917, there were long stretches of nothing happening and then just, 10-minute bursts of action in which all of your friends would die. And this entire movie, 1917, feels like it takes place within one of those bursts of action in which everybody is dying, even though we're focused on just two characters. And then for a long stretch of the movie, one of those characters. And so the conceit here, this idea that it is told in real time, that it's all one take, although, of course, the cuts between shots have been digitally erased. I was thinking of Birdman all the way through this, which kind of had a similar, we did this all in one take, but not really kind
or
of conceit.
Rope by Hitchcock.
Yeah, sure. Where Rope, he actually zooms into like people's backs and then will pull back out again to disguise a cut. It's much, obviously much more graceful here. And I thought that there were moments where that design worked really, really well, particularly in a final moment, which is in the trailer where the actor George Mackay is running across the battlefield in the opposite direction almost from where everybody else is going, or he's running perpendicular to them rather. And that's a thrilling moment. And it's all because we've watched this camera kind of serpentine throughout, and then it pulls back and we see the scope of it. But for a lot of this movie, I don't know if the one take thing totally worked for me because I was constantly thinking about the one take thing. Maybe other people won't be as distracted by it, but so much of it looks like a video game, and I was thinking about the fact that
there were definitely parts that looked video game-ish.
Because the camera's constantly following our characters from behind, so it kind of feels like a shooter game almost. Each scene is like a new level that presents another hurdle that the characters have to cross. And those scenes are kind of interspersed by these cameos from big name actors like Benedict Cumberbatch and Colin Firth, who come in and provide helpful exposition to get you to the next level. So I think that there are really good things about 1917. The technical craft here is remarkable, and I don't think anyone would fault it for that. But I was pulled out of it a lot because I kept thinking about the technical craft, and there were moments where it got a little monotonous for me. Like even at 2 hours, this felt a little long. But I mean, there are stretches of it that are just exhilarating, and you do think at times, how did they do that? And sometimes you go to the movies to say, how did they do that? And they did it here.
Well, and so you're – focus on the one take conceit, as you called it, which is accurate, did not affect me. I mean, initially I was looking for it. And so then I just sort of made my peace with it and moved on. I guess I was most taken with the performances of the two young leads.
They're really good, yeah.
And I think that was brilliant to cast people amongst these A-list actors who are not really known actors, at least, especially to us in the States. And so I think that
George MacKay in particular.
Yeah. And so I think that was wonderful because that would have pulled me out of the movie if they had some big name stars.
Jake Gyllenhaal. Yeah.
Well, and of course, Christopher Nolan did that in Dunkirk as well. The actors
correct.
In that were,
I
mean, obviously Harry Styles was one of the actors.
And Tom Hardy.
Yeah, sure. But they weren't – Tom Hardy wasn't one
that
of
was
the
– That was pre-Tom Hardy, right.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought that was really effective. I liked the way that he managed the pacing of the film because I do think, Nathan, as you point out, Mendez has these like sort of frantic moments. And then there'll be sort of the slogging, really, truly slogging through the mud, coming upon a woman who has – the care of a baby in this abandoned house in this French town. So I think that there were these big moments and frantic moments and then these more subtle, slow moments. And I liked the pacing of it very much.
Yeah, and I agree with both of you to a certain extent. I'm more on Mary Pat's side in terms of how the conceit of the single take affected me. And maybe that was because I've been so prepared for it, having seen the trailer 317,000 times before we actually saw the movie.
1,917 times.
Yeah, right, yeah. Actually, nothing about 1917 bothered me. The thing that does bother me is I was reading some reviews in which the movie was being taken apart simply because it doesn't emphasize the nature of war and the political ramifications of what was going on in 1917 itself. And it's like, that to me, that's totally ridiculous.
Well, that's not what the movie is about.
Exactly. The movie doesn't have to emphasize that because the movie immerses itself in it. And every single person we come along talks about the futility of what's going on. And the final climactic scene, we have a person going, well, you know, it ain't today. It's going to be tomorrow. We're going to be going across and everybody's going
to
die.
Right.
So we all know this.
We don't need to have somebody come in and give
precisely,
a TED talk on why World War I matters.
I think 1917, if I had to do all over again, I would have put it on my top 10 list and maybe kicked out something like I don't know. Joker, maybe. You know, I don't know.
Well, yeah.
I don't know. I'd have to really think about it.
I wouldn't put this on my top 10 list, but I did like it. And I don't like it as much as something like Dunkirk, for instance, which I think is really tremendous.
Dunkirk takes, I think, a couple of showings to really fully see what Nolan is doing.
It's a really rich movie.
Exactly.
And Mary Pat, you talked about the pacing of 1917. I love a good ticking clock movie. You know, we talked about that with Uncut Gems. This is similar in some ways.
And it's also the quintessential.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, you have X amount of time to do Y thing.
To save 1,600 men.
Yes. I love a plot like that. But the moments that stick out to me about this movie were not the big camera tricks and choreography. It's the small moments.
How about the quiet scene? The quiet scene, yes. When the George the Schofield character comes upon these people in the woods
and,
the guy's singing.
Yes, that
one
was
guy is singing.
Or
yes.
The moment right before he finds the woman with the baby, he comes across this small town square that has been decimated, and there's a church that's on fire. And it's illuminating this entire town square. And it's kind of this moment of surreal beauty where he stops and almost becomes hypnotized by it.
Yeah.
We do too. And then he's thrown right back into the action. It was those moments that actually stick in my brain more than Roger Deakins and his massive, you know, camera team, you know, riding motorcycles
and George
with
McKay's
cameras
face,
attached to them, you know.
Yeah,
he's
Schofield.
Got those big saucer-like eyes.
Right. And so he doesn't look like your classic sort of hero. And the other fellow who says, oh, when you get there, you'll recognize my brother. And I was like, well, I don't know. You don't look exactly like Richard Madden, but sure.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Whatever.
Well, and I think like Dunkirk, this is a war movie that it's very much about the style in which it's presented, and it should be seen on a big screen.
I agree.
So you can,
totally.
You can get the visuals and the sound as well.
And that was 1917. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Two Popes and A Hidden Life. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss Sam Mendes' Golden Globe-winning war film, 1917. Let's now move to a couple of other critically acclaimed 2019 films, The Two Popes and A Hidden Life. Let's begin with a profile of a man who said no. Terrence Malick is one of those filmmakers who has a trademark style. As shown to good effect in such films as 2005's The New World and 2011's The Tree of Life, and to lesser effect in 2012's To the Wonder, that style doesn't fit every narrative that Malick chooses to explore. Case in point, A Hidden Life, Malick's portrayal of a story based on real events. Franz Jagerstatter was an Austrian farmer who in 1943 refused to swear an oath of loyalty to Adolf Hitler and as a result was imprisoned and condemned to death. In telling Jagerstatter's story, Malick uses the same sweeping meditative style for which he is famous, one that stresses shots of nature blended with adoring close-ups of the actors he has hired, in this case, August Diehl and Valerie Packner, all captured by a camera that continually moves, with dialogue relegated mostly to narration and used in a manner that seldom brings us close to the characters who recite the lines. The big problem is one of specificity. When his theme is large, as it was in The Tree of Life, which contrasted family dysfunction with the very essence of existence, Malick's style tends to work. When he is trying to make a more personal point, as with Jagerstatter, whose moral stance was both noble and selfish at once, it is far less effective.
And Dan, you know that I'm not the Malick fan that you are, so maybe I appreciated this film in some different ways. My problem with the film, because it was beautiful, and anybody who goes to the theater on a regular basis, the movie theaters, has seen multiple trailers of this. A Hidden Life is beautiful, of course, because that's one of the highlights of his filmmaking. But I think my problem with the film was it simultaneously provides too much context and too little context. So, for example, we are never sure, or I was never sure, let's say, what was the reason for Jagerstatter to do what he was doing. I mean, we don't know if this came from some deeply entrenched moral or religious belief. We get the sense that it's religious because he talks to a priest, he talks to a bishop. But we don't see that sort of forming the central core of who he is and his identity. And when the lead character has a wife and a mother and children, to make this decision without giving us more, I found a little confounding. But Malick is always a little confounding. Mm-hmm. And since you're an aficionado, maybe I would defer to your expertise here. It is an almost 3-hour long movie.
And it feels every second of it, you know. People are either Malick fans or they aren't. And I think The Tree of Life is one of the great films made in my lifetime. I liked A New World. I like both those movies. Go all the way back to Badlands. I like that also. But A Hidden Life just misses it. And it's because he can't tell certain stories with his style. His style has to be one of meditation and just enthralling you with what's going on rather than trying to actually answer questions like you're asking, Mary Pat. So I think Hidden Life was a missed opportunity.
But well, I mean, this will be a nice segue to our next discussion.
That's
The real character, the Jagerstatter character, was actually beatified by Pope Benedict the 16th.
Yeah.
And so, again, I think after the fact, we get maybe a stronger sense of his religious motivation.
Right. And so that brings us to the movie The Two Popes, which is our third film of this show. When Pope Benedict the 16th renounced his title in 2013, it made headlines. Nothing like that had occurred in nearly 800 years. And his replacement, the Argentina-born Pope Francis, was something new. As liberal in some ways as the German-born Benedict was conservative. The Two Popes, which was directed by Brazilian-born filmmaker Fernando Meirelles, best known for his 2002 film City of God, tells the story of how the papal changeover occurred and of how two religious leaders of different philosophies, not to mention temperaments, became friendly in the process. For all of Meirelles' talent, what really makes The Two Popes worth watching is the acting of the two veteran stars, Jonathan Pryce as Francis and Anthony Hopkins as Benedict. Their performances, both of which are Oscar-nominated, amount to a virtual acting seminar.
Well, I'd like to call this movie Too Many Popes because I thought it was endless. I love the idea of this movie. But I think that its consideration of faith, both these two men's respective faiths and just kind of the idea of faith in general and the very institution of the Catholic Church, to be really surface level, really lightweight. The tone is so cutesy for a lot of it, even though it is dealing with some heavy subject matter, especially in these flashbacks of Pope Francis's younger life. And for a lot of this movie, Meirelles is shooting it like he's still making City of God. There are all these bizarre kind of gritty handheld close-ups when they don't need to be there. And so the whole thing just I don't understand this movie at all. Maybe it's because I'm not Catholic and so therefore it just doesn't hit me in the right way. But I've liked, as you talked about, I've liked Terrence Malick films that deal with similar subjects. I've liked Scorsese films that have dealt with similar subjects. So yeah, this didn't work. Even Jonathan Pryce whistling ABBA didn't win me over. I just
Well, and I guess for those of us who might be a little bit more deeply immersed in some of the conflict in the church in various ways and on various levels, there was something almost whimsical about this that I found a little refreshing. I would like to think that these two popes actually had a course of dealing with one another that is not what we see publicly, which is this Pope Emeritus refusing to stay in his lane and sort of interfering with what Francis is doing now. And that's regardless of what you think about any of their philosophies and so forth. If you were the Pope and you stepped down, you stepped down. And so I guess I found this to be refreshing. And of course, I loved watching both of these actors. So I appreciate fully how this is not going to be for everyone. And I was a little surprised in some ways that it got so much traction in terms of the Academy Award buzz. Both of these actors were nominated in their respective categories.
Nominated. This movie is Green Book, but with two popes.
We have to point out
that
Anthony McCartan's script is it's a work of imagination.
It's not very good.
There weren't any cameras sitting there with these two popes as they were talking, you know. So
I would have preferred that.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm being too hard on this because I saw it post Oscar nomination. But we could talk about that. I don't understand how Jonathan Pryce got a nomination for Best Actor over Adam Sandler in Uncut Gems or even Robert De Niro in The Irishman. So I guess that's par for the course when we're talking
about
the Oscars.
So let's continue on with this. We only got a couple of minutes here, but let's talk about the snubs and surprises of the Oscar nominations.
So I just named my big one.
Yeah, you did. For me, how does Joker get 11 nominations, more than The Irishman, more than Marriage Story.
More than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood,
more
than Parasite.
Seriously, I just don't know what's going on.
It's remarkable to
here.
Me because I think we all liked Joker to various degrees.
I did like Joker.
Joaquin Phoenix, I totally understand why he was nominated for Best Actor. But the most nominated film of the year is in a year like 2019, which had such riches,
exactly.
Is really
such adult
peculiar
riches
to me.
All
yeah.
Right. Mary Pat?
Well, I guess my big question is having to do with Greta Gerwig. I mean, her direction of Little Women, which was my favorite film of last year, was masterful. And the fact that she was overlooked for Todd Phillips, for example,
yes.
Again, Dan's concern about the Joker, was a tragedy. No, that's – tragedy is too large.
A disappointment.
Yeah, it was a disappointment
for me. Towering disappointment, but not a tragedy.
Okay,
I would also
enough.
Say that the fact that the editing of Little Women was also overlooked by the Academy.
Right.
And I think that the editing and the direction of that film is what makes it so lively. At least she was nominated for her screenplay.
Right. And I think the other surprise, Kathy Bates' nomination for yep. Richard Jewell, mm-hmm. I was
Which
pleased with that.
I think that's my favorite Kathy Bates performance.
What?
Yes, because she's
– What are you talking
there.
About?
She finally
oh,
understates
dear.
Rather than...
You know, you can borrow my copy of Misery. Rewatch
no,
that.
Oh, yeah,
get
right.
Back
exactly.
No,
I was just
you.
Thinking about
no,
that.
No, no, no,
well, and then I actually appreciated the film Bombshell. To say I liked it might be too strong. But Charlize Theron and Margot Robbie both got nominated. And Jennifer Lopez, I'm sorry.
She
I thought
was
she was
out.
Great
for Hustlers.
In Hustler.
Yes.
And she was not included.
The
so
fact,
I guess...
Again, the fact that... Jennifer Lopez isn't nominated, but Margot Robbie, again, I prefer her performance in something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood
yes.
than her performance in Bombshell. But it makes me think that the Academy just didn't see Hustlers because that Jennifer Lopez performance is the strongest element in a strong movie. So it's just, you know, it's disappointing. But I mean, the Oscars pretty much exist just so we can complain about them. And I think we will continue to complain about them for the next, few weeks. I think the show is on February 9th. So you'll definitely be hearing more from us about Joker's 11 nominations.
And that's all the time we have. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed the World War I drama, 1917, the religious study, The Two Popes, and Terrence Malick's A Hidden Life. Let's take this moment to thank Peter Glarberg for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again brave the world of contemporary cinema. Until then, remember these words from the author Margaret Atwood. War is what happens when language fails. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.